Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we're going to do the fifth episode of Wayne Jett. We have six total that we did covering the Great Depression up through 2008 crisis. But I'm going to have him back in a couple weeks, and we're just going to talk about the Elite Manifesto that H.G. Wells wrote back in the turn of the last century and how that affected the times and the politics and how that ultimately leads up to today. Very interesting. I don't think people really know much about the Elite Manifesto, and I want to know more about it. And he did a lot of research into that. So that's going to be coming up in a couple weeks. I also want to remind you that if you want to get a copy of his book, The Fruits of Graft, you can go to his website at classiccapital.com. And I have links on my website at sarahwestall.com. Also, all of his episodes are going to be up there and also on YouTube. And if you want to subscribe to my newsletter, make sure you do that. And my Patreon account, I'm slowly building supporters there. And I wanted to get to 100. And once I got to 100, I was going to do special content just for them. Right now, I'm not quite at 20. So if you want to help me, I would really appreciate it. I've had a couple supporters that have given me quite a bit a month, which I really thank you so much for supporting in that way. It's making a big dent on my monthly costs. I'd like to just make sure it's all covered. So I want to get now into my interview with Wayne Jett. Hi, Wayne. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Very happy to be here. I'd like to just say one thing in terms of the ending of our last discussion. My intention and my discussions with you is to present historical facts and clear and valid analysis, not to rely on emotions. And sometimes when I fall short of that, I apologize, but that's my intent. And so we're going to go from that point today. So let's do it.
Okay, let's go. There has been some additional questions that people had online. Do you want to answer a couple of those first before we go back? Okay. One thing was the plan to overthrow FDR. We had some listeners ask about General Smedley
Butler.
Butler.
I don't know anything more than they already know about Smedley Butler and that sort of thing. I would just give you my interpretation of those events in general terms, and that is that there could have been no mistake on the part of the Western of the ruling elite, the establishment, as it's called, that FDR was their guy, in my opinion, and that any attempt to overthrow him would certainly not have been by the establishment. It would have been by the opposition. If anyone, as we can see here at the present time, is interested in the so-called fascist rule, I would say that's the establishment. So in terms of exactly how to interpret what went on at that time and whose side was on, who was on whose side, essentially, you can say that General Butler prevented a president from being overthrown by a military coup or whatever you wish to call it. But whether he did so for good patriotic reasons or for purposes of carrying out the establishment's goals, I can't say. In any event, FDR stayed in office and did what he did, and he certainly was, in my opinion, a very sophisticated and well-regarded operative of the ruling elite. I think that's what the historical facts show, and that's my conclusion about it.
So it could be that when they tried to overthrow him, they were trying to keep him from doing what he was doing. And it could have been a patriotic overthrow, but there's no way to prove it one way or the other at this point.
I haven't done enough investigation to express a final conclusion about that, but the overall outcome was certainly to preserve and extend the very detrimental efforts of FDR. Let me mention to you an item on him that I have not had the chance to include in our discussion. It's included in my book, but I believe it was in the fall of 33. It might have been the fall of 34, but the autumn. But it was early in his first term. FDR wrote a personal letter to a man by the name of Edward M. House, known as Colonel House. He was well known not so much during FDR's term. He had become well known in public before that because he was the go-between between the ruling elite of Wall Street and Woodrow Wilson during Wilson's term. And so he was certainly one plugged in with the establishment and, you know, out of the limelight during FDR, but nevertheless, someone in which with whom Roosevelt decided to have that personal exchange. And he wrote him a letter. I quote two sentences from that letter, both of which are, I don't have them right in front of me because I didn't have this question in mind. But essentially, those two sentences are, you and I both know that every administration since Andrew Jackson, that would have ended in 1836, every administration of this government since Andrew Jackson has been owned by the financial sector of a certain portion of this country. That's a significant sentence. The next sentence was just as significant, but it didn't dawn on me just how until quite some pondering about it. The second sentence was, and it immediately followed the first one, it said, right now we are engaged in much the same battle that Andrew Jackson was engaged in, but now it is being fought on a much broader scale. Now let's examine that last point. Andrew Jackson's battle was absolutely, definitely full out against the privately owned central bank that was owned at that time, was owned privately, just as the Fed is. So to say that in the Great Depression and the poverty and anguish and so forth of all of that, that right now we're fighting the same battle on a much broader front, is to say that this is a battle between the people and the people who own the central bank, fought on a broader front. It means that we're fighting the same battle, but this time the president is on the side of the big bank, the ruling elite, not like Jackson was, absolutely against it. So that, in my opinion, was an explicit private statement by FDR that we are fighting to depose and demolish the people of this country on behalf of the central bank. Okay, next question.
Someone brought up Afghanistan and the Great Game. Did that have any influence on what was going on?
Well, Afghanistan, I don't know what the reference is to the Great Game. I can tell you what I think Afghanistan was about.
Okay.
It was about taking over the poppy production of Afghanistan and expanding it. I think it's now 10 to 15 times larger than it was at the time the Taliban was ruling the country. They were basically stamping out the production of heroin, poppies, in Afghanistan. The ruling elite of this country, primarily the Bush Clinton syndicate and those who operate the illicit drug trafficking, wanted that production, and they got it. There have been many reports from many sources that I think are factual that indicate that our military still protects those fields and still transports the heroin out of that country into other places that we fought in the Middle East. Not so much the Middle East, as I think that goes first to Turkey and then into a part of the part where we invaded part of Yugoslavia back under Clinton's administration in the late 90s, because that is where it is processed into heroin and so forth. So I think all the reports I hear that I credit indicate that's why Afghanistan war happened, why they happened to be picked as the place that so-called Osama bin Laden was holed up. It was false from the beginning. Osama bin Laden was a CIA agent at the time of his death, which was about 2 months or 3 months. It was December right after 9/11, 2001.
So the killing that happened later, and they made this big, you know, parade out of it, that was just a acting job.
They just picked their time to help his reelection at the time that was selected. Bush had was already, you know, got his two terms and didn't use it. But nevertheless, Obama saw fit to do so.
Okay.
And a great tragedy of that was the later assassination of the SEAL team that was sent in to do that and knew about it. At least they were. It was said that they were sent in to do it, and they wound up being put into a Vietnam Air helicopter and blown to pieces in Afghanistan. Or in Iraq. I can't tell you which one of those wars it was, but they sent them down a canyon at night. At least that was what it was said. But I'm not expert in that. And so all I can do is report where I think what I think I've seen reported from the most credible sources. And that's the agreement on basically what was done about Osama bin Laden.
Somebody else brought up Teddy Roosevelt and how he fit into the picture.
Yes, well, I'd like to respond to that. The way I want to do it is to say that Teddy Roosevelt and Henry George met in life as opponents in the mayoral race of New York City in 1886. Let me just say as background, Henry George, while writing his great book, Progress and Poverty, during the 1870s, that was, by the way, let me remind you, that was the time of the longest economic contraction in U.S. history, caused by the statute that deflated the dollar to a higher value over that period of time. During that period of time was exactly when Henry George was writing his great book, and at the same time that he was writing it, his newspaper in California, as did many other businesses across the country during that time period, went bankrupt. So his business was failing while he was writing it, and then it became the big hit, as I've told you, and got a New York publisher. And when that happened and it really went gangbusters, he moved to New York City. He became the highly respected figure across the nation and really around the world that I mentioned to you, described to you earlier. He was so well respected, second or third highest rated respected person in the country, that there was a famous labor leader in New York City, Samuel Gompers, and others who were sick of the corruption of Tammany Hall running the Democratic Party, which supposedly the party of the people, but you know the corruption was too much for them. And they recruited Henry George to run for mayor of New York City. He didn't really have the aspirations, but they talked him into it at some length. It was described later by a Columbia University historian as I could quote his comments, but he said it was by far the most outstanding political contest in New York City history in terms of the qualifications of the and capabilities of the candidates. The candidate, he was therefore, Henry George was the Labor Party candidate. The Democrats recruited a man to run as their candidate that was unbelievably high standing so far as that race is concerned. He had been an industrialist and steel magnate. His company had been merged into Andrew Carnegie's company to form U.S. Steel. So he was extremely wealthy. He had also run for Congress, had been majority leader in the U.S. House of Representatives. And they called him home to New York City to run against Henry George. The Republican candidate, Theodore Roosevelt. So they had the debates, so forth and so on. It came right down to the wire. It was a two-man race. The other candidate for the Democratic Party, I can tell you his name if I can pull up my outline again. I apologize for not having it right in front of me. But here we are, just a minute. Oh boy, this is taking a little bit too long. But
don't worry about it. I can cut this
out. Here it is. Abram Hewitt was his name. And the contest was neck and neck with Abram Hewitt and Henry George.
So the other two,
Theodore Roosevelt was hardly even on the gauge in terms of his support.
And then either was the one that was the majority party.
No, Abram Hewitt was the other candidate.
Oh, okay. So he was the steel magnet guy. The steel magnet was the one that didn't even get a blip.
Highly thought of, and running neck and neck with Henry George. It was Teddy Roosevelt that was the pony that was still coming around the turn when everyone else was the finish line. At the conclusion of the campaign, by the way, during the campaign, the Democratic Party Tammany Hall offered to George, if he would drop out of the race, they offered him a safe seat in Congress. He turned it down. They ran the race to the finish. At the finish, Abram Hewitt narrowly won. Very narrowly, and in fact, Henry George charged there was election fraud. So it was a heated race, but here's the money quote from Teddy Roosevelt. He declared on his concession statement that he had run his campaign in the general desire to decisively defeat the economic theories represented by Henry George, a desire with which I most heartily sympathized. So it's absolutely clear he was absolutely against solving the problem of Henry George and solving the problems of poverty. But of course, it would have been voiced probably in the vernacular of socialism, anti-socialism, all this sort of stuff. And that's the way that race turned out. Then, of course, what happened with Teddy after that is he was put on the ticket as vice president when William McKinley, who was already president in the late 90s, 1890s, McKinley ran for re-election in 1900, and Teddy was put on his ticket as the vice president, was vice president when McKinley was then shot shortly after being re-elected due to his, there's always a lone assassin. That one was called something in the nature of, the ones who don't want government at all. I forget the term right this moment.
Anarchist?
Yes, anarchist. But it was undoubtedly because McKinley's agenda with the financial world was not acceptable to the establishment, and out he goes. To me, that certainly says that Teddy was very much establishment, very much for the ruling elite, and there are many indications of that further, not the least of which is that, for example, in his trust busting, he busted his enemies' companies for trust, doing trusts. His friends did just great. The rest of it is, I would say, you can chalk it up to the establishment. The fact that he invited over H.G. Wells to celebrate his writing of the manifesto for the shadow government, the New Republic, how to destroy democracy, how to destroy the middle class, how to go back to the two-class system. And remember that H.G. Wells called him the human demigod of whom I have dreamed. So I just make this comment. Anytime the historical press, the mainstream media have made somebody into a hero, you better look closely, because ordinarily there's a pretty good rule of thumb that such a hero created by the mainstream media is one that is a puppet of the ruling elite. And I would have to go with that conclusion in regard to Theodore Roosevelt.
And it happens the opposite way, right, as well. When there's somebody in office that is destroyed by the media, it's...
or shot,
yes.
Yeah. That would be the case. I think that's a pretty good second rule of thumb. So any other question?
I think that is good for now, because I would like to spend time on the Keynes Mutiny and discuss the difference between classical economics and the Keynes Mutiny that happened, which is really which allowed everything to occur going forward with economic policy.
All right. Let me do one more thing, though. Before we leave the subject of the Roosevelts, I would want to mention that I devote an entire chapter in my book to I title Understanding Franklin. It's a personal portrait of who FDR was as a person his whole life. We won't go into it here, but I think it's the best that I've ever seen about it. It's based upon what is reported by others in other historical works, but it's they are the kinds of revealing facts that no one ever has brought to the point of really facing the facts of who he really was. And so I commend that. I think it's the best personal analysis of Franklin Roosevelt that certainly that I'm aware of. So I mentioned that, and go ahead with your question now.
Well, I would like to discuss the Keynes Mutiny, and I was hoping you could elaborate on this. What changed from classical economics? Because he changed his views, and that really ushered in all the stuff that we have now.
It happened that it ushered it in simply because it was recognized as he did it, that it was a very useful tool for the ruling elite, because it turned everything on its head. It was confusing enough that they couldn't really be identified as mercantilism personified. But as I told you when we spoke earlier about it, the expert on mercantilism at that time was the Swedish economist Eli Heckscher, and he immediately recognized it. You know, he's talking about mercantilism. He's switching his entire views, and he's going to the dark side. These are the views of mercantilists, and he's providing excuses for the kind of policies that they've always had. And, of course, as I've said to you, mercantilism and mercantilists regard capitalists as their arch enemy, capitalism being the system for the middle class, allowing it to grow. The theory of the firm, that's what classical capital is all about.
So Keynes was a very popular economist that was supported classical economics. And then he switched in the early 30s.
Yes.
And that is the Keynes Mutiny that you're talking about.
Yes. His father had been, in his entire career, he was a highly regarded professor of classical economic theory at Cambridge University in England. The son, John Maynard Keynes, became the same. He took the same position. He was a longtime professor of classical economic theory at Cambridge University. He had written his entire career in the same vein his father had, and refuted all of these crazy ideas about how to stimulate this or control that or what have you. He had called those things out as completely invalid. And when he wrote this general theory, he made the excuse that, well, from a young child, I was misled. I was taught that we had really nothing to learn from the ideas of mercantilism. I have come to think that classical theory doesn't work in the special situation in which there's no incentive for new investment, which is really, if you don't mind my vernacular, I apologize for it, but I'll just say it's gibberish. It makes no sense. And so much of what he argued in that case, that's what that chapter on the Keynes Mutiny is about. It is about his going to the dark side and coming up with these ideas. I've listed 10 points of error that are clearly made, that can be demonstrated, and that are accepted as errors today, and yet they still call that book a great book. I mean, it makes no sense. It's hardly even worth picking up in terms of the quality of the ideas that it presented. And yet, that's what it amounted to. Now, how did he come to that? He had written a two-volume work in 1930 that he thought was his life's work. It was about the theory of money or something like that, is what he called it. And he had gotten into an academic row with another professor at the London School of Economics, also well thought of at the time. But they argued back and forth, and it got very bitter and that sort of thing. But there's another element that also was running in Keynes's thinking at that time. Because of his position as in classical economics professorship, he was given the responsibility of running the endowment funds or something of that sort, a large amount of money for Cambridge University. And he had had success in that endeavor during the 1920s, investing in stocks and bonds and so forth and so on, whatever it was he picked. Now, in that regard, I have not researched exactly what his experience was when the Depression started, whether he was brought to the inside by his contacts in the financial world and told to get out before the crash, as so many did of the insiders. And not only did they so-called get out of being long, they went into a position of being short, of being the short sellers, as I described that Joseph B. Kennedy did, for example. Many did that. Bernard Baruch was most certainly another a major player in that regard. I have another story that I could tell you about his conversation at the home of Franklin Roosevelt in New York City before he was inaugurated about the subject of silver.
Yes, talk about that. That would be interesting.
All right. The oldest daughter of the Roosevelts married a young stockbroker, financial guy with, I think, the predecessor of Lehman Brothers or something like that at that time during the 1920s. And at the time of the inauguration, the son-in-law and the daughter were living at the Roosevelt Mansion in New York City. And the son-in-law came home from work and you know, went into the parlor, and there was sitting Bernard Baruch, a very substantial man. He had become a far up on the scale of multimillionaires during World War One, when by that time he was already head of the board that took care of all the war purchasing for the government war effort. And he had become very wealthy in that connection in his investments. Well, he was sitting there, and he had been, of course, he was one at the time, a very close advisor, confidential advisor of FDR. And he was sitting in the parlor waiting to be called up to FDR's bedroom upstairs for a private meeting. And when the son-in-law walked in, he immediately recognized Bernard Baruch and introduced himself, very nice, and so forth and so on. And they were sitting there together, or not really together, but across the room, and but the only ones there. And the son-in-law was thinking about it and wondering how to continue the conversation, because Baruch hadn't been, really conversant much with him. And so he looked up and noticed that Baruch was staring at him. And suddenly Bernard Baruch says to him, "I'm very high on silver." Obviously, something that to a stockbroker could be a tip that could change your life. And so they continued their conversation a little bit on that, and the son-in-law sort of inquired with him. And anyway, to make a long story short, Baruch said something in the order that I own a certain percentage. I can't remember the amount, except that it was a significant percentage of all of the silver that is above the surface of the earth in the world. So in other words, he was telling the son-in-law, "I'm telling you, I'm high on silver, and I own an immense amount of it presently." Okay? Well, the son-in-law was so enamored with having this conversation, he says that he wrote a book and related this some years later. And he said, "I went back to the office, but it didn't even occur to me to alert people there about this thing as to, you know, what a reason there is to invest in this thing if Bernard Baruch thinks it's a great time to buy. Well, right after that comment, Baruch was called upstairs and he left the parlor, and that was the end of their conversation. The point I would make is that after being sworn in on March 15th, I think it was by May 15th of the same year, 1933, the U.S. government increased the price it paid for silver by double.
So there was a back deal negotiation so that he could make a killing.
Well, he certainly did make a killing, no doubt in my mind about it. And yes, I feel certain there would have been discussions of that nature, but nevertheless, that is the kind of activity that was going on at the time. And there are other aspects that I've relayed in my book about the Baruch situation and how it was that he came to be out of the market and the crash of 1929. You know, that would have been 4 years earlier. The way he relates it, he was hunting grouse in Scotland in his annual retreat there one afternoon, and it suddenly dawned on him, a feeling came over him that he should go back to the U.S. and sell everything.
Yeah.
Well, the record indicates that he never told anybody else that he was now changing his mind on the market at that time, but nevertheless he did, and the evidence available indicates, although his tax return is not fully available, that he was very short the market. He didn't just get out of the market. He got very short the market at the right time in order to participate in the orchestrated crash that happened in 1929. So there we are.
Well,
what else can we talk about?
Let's talk about after Roosevelt. You discuss a mercantilism, two-party domination. How did this develop, and can you tell us more about that?
Well, let's talk, if we can, maybe we can tie it into coming out of World War II. In 1944, while the war was still going, it was about the time of D-Day. D-Day was June 6th of 44, but it was in 1944, there was a, we had the Bretton Woods Conference to talk about monetary policy. Well, by that time, it certainly was clear to the U.S. and it was clear to others in the know that we had substantially gathered all of the gold from the countries that had been on the gold standard. No other country had a large reserve, and we had a very large reserve of gold. And so there was a discussion about, well, what kind of international trade system we're going to have. Nobody has gold to back their currency except the United States. So they came up with the deal, the Bretton Woods Accord, by which the U.S. would provide a gold-backed currency, although they wouldn't let the Americans participate in it, exchanging their currency for gold. Other nations of the world could exchange their currency. They could exchange dollars for gold in the foreign central banks. And so the dollar, therefore, became the currency used around the world for international trade. And that was a big deal. It made the United States the biggest power in the world and the certainly the most imperial power in terms of economic leverage over every other country.
Now, before that, it was the British pound, right?
Yes.
Now, what did that do to Britain and their power in the world once their money was not the dominant currency?
Well, I think there could certainly be debate about that in general terms. Of course, they were in a weaker position than they had been previously, but that is in the gross or general area. Others would say, and very likely with good reason, that the powers of the ruling elite still, in large part, had their connections in the City of London and in Great Britain, in the crowns of Europe, and so forth. We talked about the wars and the great amount of killing, the tremendous numbers of lives lost there. In that regard, as I go along here, I want to make a little correction or comment to further the discussion we had about the number of deaths in World War I. I stated the last time we spoke initially that Russia had lost 20 million lives in World War I, and then I wasn't sure whether that might have included World War II. Well, I had an email from a longtime friend and a very capable man in California in response to that, who listened to your report, and he gave me the numbers. If I can make it happen here on my email, just a moment. Here it is. He gave me the actual numbers, and I was pretty close to right the first time. The Russians had 18 million deaths in World War I. 11 million of them were military, 7 million were civilian. 23 million, in addition, wounded. So that's the kind of killing that was going on. And when you put that in the perspective of all that went on, those battles that happened, destroying so many without any particular point, it makes me have the idea that perhaps this was simply an exercise by the crowns of Europe, that they were going to shed themselves of some of their population in order to, maybe avert trouble in the down the line in the future or something of the sort. It certainly was the kind of autogenocide that I mentioned in our last conversation, it seems to me, and whether it was really a friendly game among the opposing governments is a question to be considered. But let's see. Let's get back to now where you wanted me to go in regard to the after the war.
I was asking you about the British pound. Now, do you think the City of London was still controlling the US dollar at that point just through the Federal Reserve, or did the US really gain that power?
I think the same ruling elite was running the Fed all the time, and they're very much the same running the Bank of England. There's some, I will say, national competition there, but the closest of allies is supposedly we've always been with the British, although quite a number of our wars have been against them, certainly in the early days. That relationship is very close. The Rothschilds of both Great Britain and Germany and France and so forth were also financial backers of Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan and so forth, the financiers. And so the alliances and the competition there has been there for, well, really all of our existence. Remember, the colonies were in existence as mercantilist colonies of the crowns of Europe for 175 years at least. So they were well entrenched, and they never left here. New York, our financial center, was not British. It was Dutch, and developed in a very baronial way from the very beginning, which gave rise to the kind of ruling elite in New York and on Wall Street that we still have today. That's an interesting story in itself that I go into in some detail. There are two major river systems in the state of New York. Those were developed in great barony estates by Netherlands, by the Dutch. And each barony was, if you wanted both sides of the river, then you got all of the land from that riverside all the way up to the top of the valley. On both sides, you got 7 miles worth of river frontage. If you wanted only one side of the river, the barony was 14 miles of river front. So these were very large land holdings handed out to people called patroons, and they ruled those places in the state of New York as if they were the law in themselves. It resulted in the hanging of one man who, among the common people who were working for them, that was trying to, you know, get some more rights for farmers who were working for them. That's a story that goes into the nature of what New York has been about its entire time and why it could come to be something that FDR had said is the ownership of every administration since Andrew Jackson. That was as of 1934, and it certainly has not changed for the better as far as the middle class is concerned since that time. So that is the kind of thing. Yes, we became certainly the military power. Some maybe in Britain would say that, well, we were just harvesting your young men in order to be the fighters and the edge of our sword in these various places that we're going to attack and overrun around the world. But Britain really never gave up its final say on how things are done and that sort of thing. Those kind of things can be debated, but in terms of whether we can debate that the rulership of Britain and the rulership of the United States is under the domination of the ruling elite that is global in nature, although parceled up in nations of people that have their own identities and are in many times given the ideas that that they really are able to elect their own governments. It is one that those governments exist, as Henry George said, under the influence of a powerful pecuniary force that writes all of our laws and molds all of our thinking. So let's go from this point perhaps to where we get to after the dollar is already in that position. From the Bretton Woods, we have a dollar that is backed by gold at $35 an ounce, and we proceed from 1945 in that position, and it continues until 1971. During that period of time, parties across the sea can cash in their dollars for gold at $35 an ounce. Now, if you are part of the ruling elite and you know that the long-term strategy or tactic is going to be to float the value of the dollar and to take it off the gold standard. You're going to be buying as much $35 gold as you can get. And you can do that by getting your dollars and taking them to central banks overseas, which the international banks are very able to do. And so they can buy that gold. And so the gold stores of the United States started dwindling from the time that system was put in place, with the people in the know being in a position of buying the gold at $35 an ounce, particularly during the Vietnam War of the 1960s. And Nixon didn't want interest rates to rise and didn't want to raise taxes. And so basically, he had the Fed print more dollars. And obviously, the elite knew that. Wall Street knew that. Interest rates did rise somewhat, but they knew that the dollar was going to have to be devalued eventually, and that came to pass in 1971. The way it was announced was by Richard Nixon from Camp David, August 15th, 1971. He came down from a meeting there, or from the meeting there. He said basically that France had come forward with a request to please send its gold back over there, and they had requested that a large number of dollars be exchanged for gold. And so it was coming to the point that we were running out of gold, and we didn't want to have to admit that. And Nixon, instead of simply devaluing the dollar or putting a rein on the expansion of dollars, he announced instead that, well, we're closing the gold window. No longer will central banks of other countries be permitted to exchange dollars for gold. We're not going to do that anymore, supposedly allowing us to keep the rest of the gold we had, which was reported at that time to be down from nearly 20 million. I'm sorry, 20,000 tons of gold to something like 9,000, 8,000 in that range metric tons of gold still left in our vaults, supposedly. After announcing, well, on that same day, August 15th, there wasn't as much attention given to his announcement of closing the gold window as there was to another announcement that he made the same day. The thing that Nixon emphasized in his announcement of August 15th was that I'm setting up a cost of living council to control inflation. We hate inflation. We don't want any of it. And I'm also setting up a wage and price controls. That's what hit the press, was given great emphasis, and of course occupied the minds and hearts of many Americans all the way through the 70s. Supposedly the war against inflation, whip inflation now, and all those silly slogans that the government had to know were completely ineffectual. They had nothing to do with why the dollar was losing value. That had everything to do with the fact that they were printing extra dollars over and above the amount that would keep the value of the dollar steady at what it was, had been, $35 an ounce.
So now the dollar ends up significantly increasing. But during that time, the elites were in the know, but the average person wasn't, that it was a great time to buy.
Yes, up until 1971. And of course, in 1972, not only, you know, after having closed the gold window to the European banks, in in 1972, Nixon announced that he was floating the value of the dollar into the market so that the market determined what the gold was really worth. And within 18 months of the time of the original announcement in August of 71, 18 months later, gold had quadrupled in price. It had gone from $35 an ounce to $140 an ounce. Now, do you think that the people in the know in the U.S. And otherwise, the ruling elite, did not load up on gold at $35 an ounce? I'm quite certain they did. And they made lots of money even after that.
That's all we have today. Be sure to look for episode 6 that'll be coming out pretty soon. I also have an interview with Cynthia McKinney that is coming out today on YouTube, and it'll be airing Monday on satellite, so people can see it over the weekend on YouTube and up on my website. We're going to address AIPAC. We're going to address the bill that just went through Congress that essentially initiates war with, escalates the tensions for sure with Russia, Iran, and North Korea. It was silent. Nobody knew about it. And she explains what that whole process was, who voted for it, who didn't. And then she addresses Robert David Steele. People are accusing him of being a CIA agent or CIA asset used to discredit Cynthia McKinney. And she just comes right out and talks about her relationship with Robert David Steele. This is a no-miss interview. It's a two-parter, and the first parter, like I said, will be out this weekend. So keep your eyes out for that. Again, sarahwestall.com. And I hope you have a great day and a great weekend.